Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
All right, this is Pete Poyon. I'm joined by Matt Bocklet. We also have two great interviewees on today, Jeremy Hirsch and Jim Mitchell of Princeton University. We'll jump into that in a second. A couple items on the news. We'd actually named our podcast the Let's Ride podcast, going back to our Outlaws days. So that's huge. That's huge step in the right direction for us. Matt, I'll let you kind of talk about that for a second. But I'm really pumped about this interview. We're going to jump right into it. Jeremy Hirsch is a guy that I got an opportunity to live with and coach with at Hobart College, which was awesome way to get your coaching career started for me anyway. And maybe we'll get into that a little bit more, but looking forward to this and this program in particular. Princeton coming off a big win yesterday against Georgetown. So we'll touch on that, but congrats to you guys on the big win.
Yeah. And I'm excited. The Let's Ride podcast. Finally, it only took us a month. For those that weren't, that don't know about the Outlaws, like Pete and I, in our good old days, our cheer before games was Outlaws, Let's Ride. And then everyone, all the players gave a yeah, like a cowboy. So we're going to set up a photo shoot with some horses and Pete and I riding off into the sunset. But very excited about this, about today's interviews with these guys. I mean, Princeton doing some great stuff early on in the season, but more importantly, we've talked about maybe, you know, some of the coaches that are doing phenomenal jobs that people don't get to hear from all the time. And these guys certainly have some interesting past to where they are now and are young in their coaching careers. So excited to for them and to see what happens with Princeton the rest of the season. So I'm going to dig in here with some bios, and I'll start with Jeremy Hirsch, who is a grad of Princeton in 2010, where he was the captain of the team. I believe the solo captain, is that correct? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty cool. That's always impressive when someone's got to be that leader by themselves. So just tells you a little bit about Coach Hirsch already. After he graduated in 2010, went on to coach at Hamden, Sydney. From there, he went to Hobart in upstate New York, where he got to coach with Pete. And now he's circled back to his alma mater, and he's been coaching at Princeton since the 2018 season. All right, Jim Mitchell. All right, this is quite a path for a young coach as well. Played at St. Mary's College, so not very typical that you see guys, you know, maybe not playing at the you know, the Princeton ranks and then working their way there. I think it's pretty special to understand as we get to know Coach Mitchell today. Starting off at St. Mary's College, where he was also a captain, graduating in 2006, went on to coach at Goucher, where he was actually the defensive coach at Goucher, now being the offensive coordinator at Princeton. From Goucher, went and coached at Roanoke. From Roanoke, he went to Duke. I believe that was 2011, a final 4 year for Duke. And then Bellarmine as an assistant for a few years, and then went to Rutgers. And I think this is really when people got to know a little bit more about Coach Mitchell, because that Rutgers offense, we're still talking about the Rutgers offense and the style of play that they have. But while Coach was there for the first time ever in program history, they were ranked number one in the country, just scoring tons of goals, playing at a fast pace, a lot of fun, very exciting stuff. From there, did one more season at Bellarmine, and now has been at Princeton since 2020. And for those that remember the 2020 season, Princeton's offense, Michael Sowers, was playing at a level maybe no one had ever seen before out of a college lacrosse player. The whole team as in general was playing great, and the offense was putting up some big numbers. So this group right here of coaches having some success early this season, when you think about some of maybe the other coaches that we got to interview, have been around and coaching together for over a decade. And now we have a group here where it's only been a few seasons and one season that didn't happen last year for the entire program. Pretty impressive what you guys have done and finding that chemistry. So we'll start with you, Jeremy. You've been there a little bit longer. Kind of talk about the staff as a whole, your evolution over these past few seasons, additions, subtractions, and just kind of how you guys are coming together and your roles among the team, the locker room, and in the office.
Sure. Well, I appreciate you guys having us. Obviously, worked with Pete up at Hobart, and that was a phenomenal experience. And then, you know, watching you, Matt, play you know, at Hopkins and then professionally. It's great to, you know, have a chance to speak with you. I mean, specifically about Princeton, I mean, I think two things that stick out. One, it starts with, you know, Matt Madelon, who heads the program, and, you know, what he fosters in the office and in the locker room is just a, you know, an identity of being very collaborative in our approaches systematically with our schemes and then with our players, like the relationships that we have an opportunity to build with is really special. And the past couple of years, although, you know, the 2020 season, Coach Mitch's first year was cut a little bit short. We still, you know, through that season and then, you know, some of the adversity we faced through COVID, you know, we spent a lot of time together, you know, talking through our processes, our schemes, our recruiting, talking to our players consistently, talking to our recruits consistently. So I think that's something that is, you're seeing some of that work come to fruition early on right now in the season is the closeness of our team, closeness of our staff, how collaborative we are, you know, coming up with different ideas, different ways to do things. You know, all of us have our core principles and standards, but we certainly aren't afraid to bring new ideas to the table and talk through those things. And then I think it builds a buy-in with our players as well. We're pretty honest and clear with our guys, trying different things out, moving guys around, especially early on in the season. So there's a certain level of buy-in that we have right now. And it's, I think you're seeing some of that come to fruition right now on the field.
Jim, why don't you tell us about how things have changed since, you know, maybe you came on the staff and, you know, systematically and just build on what some of the things that Jeremy mentioned.
No, I think the cohesive environment is really, he's head on, hit that nail on the head with that. I think all of us, we come from different places and different backgrounds, but we do have some shared experiences. We've all coached in the ODAC Division III league. And when you coach in Division III, you do everything. And it's not just from the lacrosse side, but planning the trips, all that, you know, talking about different things, having a lot on your plate at a very early age in coaching. So I think those are shared experiences that we've continued. I would also mention our director of operations, Drew Cottrell, came over from Muhlenberg, and just a really good, you know, coaching mind as well. So our office is a very open environment. And then obviously Chris Aslanian, he's our volunteer assistant, but, you know, we like to call him the director of player development because he's a pro athlete who gets tons of live shots on our goalies, is able to really talk the intricacies of shooting and mechanical development with our guys. So again, like, you know, we have guys that are currently playing. Our strength coach, Mark Ellis, was playing in the MLL, really modern with his approach to things and developing our guys. So it's a real team of like-minded individuals, again, with different backgrounds, but a lot of shared experiences.
I'm glad you brought up Coach A. He's a stud. He's, you know, I'm not afraid to say this. He's my favorite guy I've ever coached, for sure. I was in Matt's year a lot during that draft process, and it was amazing to see what he did with the Outlaws in like a really good situation as a player. And I still think he's got a great career ahead with the Whip Snakes, and I'm looking forward to see how his coaching career evolves. But I'm glad you mentioned him. Can you guys both quickly just tell us about the game yesterday? I mean, and we talked about it a little bit before, but you know, going through COVID, not having seasons, some of your players not getting the experience that they, you know, signed up for, and that's outside of everyone's control. But now to play a big game, have the schedule that you guys put together, which is phenomenal, and get an opportunity at the number three team in the country, and then go out and beat them on their home field. I mean, that's pretty cool. Can you just touch quickly on how that game played out and, you know, what you guys felt like led to success there?
I'll take this one. I feel, you know, we had the opportunity to play Maryland a week before, and I'm not the first coach that said this, but when you play Maryland, it's a truth serum for where you're at. And for us, I think the most important thing was the experience of playing that game, you know, actually being on the field, playing that game. Cause, you know, we did an exercise after. Our guys were, you know, upset about the result, and the coaching staff, we wanted to play a little bit better, but we did see some promising signs. And actually having that experience. And we did an exercise after. We just went down Maryland's roster and all the guys that played in the game, and, you know, the overwhelming amount of experience that they have. You know, younger players have a hard time getting on the field. in that program as it is right now. So the reality of it was we wanted to be successful. We trained very hard. Even in the year off, I thought our guys trained hard, but they didn't play a lacrosse season. So I think, to be able to have the opportunity to be competitive and even beat Georgetown, we needed to play Maryland, and we needed to really understand where we're at, where some of our most experienced players, the players that know, Alex Slusher, who's a player that a lot of people know, a name a lot of people know, he's played in 9 games. So, that was a really valuable experience and a kind of, again, that element of truth, where you really are at, and just the idea of getting a week better and playing a team that's somewhat similar in athleticism and an ability to, impact what you want to do. I think we were able to take those lessons and apply them to game day. So proud of that effort, but certainly we needed that, that game a week before to show us exactly who we are at this point in the season.
Yeah. And that's a great point that you have there about having some young guys with very little experience of playing against a Maryland team and even a Georgetown team that has tons of experience. Talk a little bit about, I'm friends with the Pedersen family. And last year I was in Park City multiple times on ski trips, and it seemed like half your team was living and running around that town. You had guys not only not playing in games, but not even in school, because they were choosing to save the year to be able to make sure that they could play 4 seasons of college lacrosse, and they didn't want to lose a year of being able to play lacrosse because of the Ivy League rules and being at Princeton. If you're enrolled, you're gonna lose that season. So you guys are dealing with players who have less experience in the game of lacrosse, but also just being college students. So kind of talk about that and what that year looked like for some of your guys that weren't even enrolled or on campus. Jeremy, why don't you take that one?
Yeah, sure. The guys are, it's a mature group, and how they handled the year was really impressive. We had guys on different parts of the country. Some of them, grouped together, lived together. So obviously some out in Park City and other parts of the country. And, they formed a schedule as best they could in terms of training and the lacrosse piece to it. And then guys got internships and some work opportunities. It was challenging in a lot of ways, but the way that I handled it was certainly understood, some of the challenges that they were facing. And, we talked a lot about controlling what you can control. And at that time it was about, changing their bodies. They could train lacrosse and, in a certain way with, keeping a stick in their hands and, developing their game. So we talked a lot about that and, handling their business over those couple of months. And, eventually things would, improve, situations on campus would improve, and they would have an opportunity. So, the maturity with which they handled it. And we talked a ton through that process of staying focused, and, there was going to be a time where this would, the opportunity to compete again would come back. So being ready for that was a huge thing. We had to acclimate young guys that were college students for the first time, but not, on Princeton's campus. We had guys that, had little game experience as well, a little bit time in our program, in our system. So it really fell upon the seniors, the upperclassmen to, kind of to lead the way virtually or from afar. And again, it speaks a lot to the type of guys we have in our program, especially the upperclassmen and the seniors.
Well, I don't know what it looked like athletically before COVID, but certainly you guys are playing a pretty mean athletic brand of lacrosse, and it's fun to watch. So it looks like there's been, at least from an outsider's perspective, some improvements physically. All right, so Jim, tell us about, the conference as a whole, Ivy League-wise. You look at kind of how it's evolved, how coaches come in, set their cultures, and then you start to see what they're capable of from a talent perspective. But across the board, there's a lot of talent in the Ivy League. The conference as a whole is having a ton of success on the field. What do you attribute that to? Talk to us about where the Ivy League is right now and how that start date of February 1st is so different from other programs and how that impacts you positively and negatively.
Well, I'll start with the last question about the start date. And yes, as coaches, you wish you had more time. with those guys. But I will say, I like how it empowers the guys in the program, the upperclassmen. I think you hear a lot about the NESCAC and how traditionally they don't have fall ball. So, you know, on one hand, your systems have to be, you know, somewhat simple or easy to coach and explain, since all they have is captain's practices, but it allows them to really take great ownership of the program. So, you know, we are able to practice in the fall, somewhat limited in terms of hours and opportunities to practice compared to the rest of Division One. But, you know, both in the fall and, you know, before that February 1 start date, I think there are many opportunities for upperclassmen, or really the whole team, not just upperclassmen, but the guys that really take ownership. And it's also up to us to have, you know, systems in place for, you know, the main things you're asked to do in a lacrosse game that those guys can implement themselves. And I think that's an important part of, you know, coaching continuity as well, you know, within the staff, is having clear and concise, you know, messages and vocabulary you use with your team. But I think in some ways that's an advantage. You know, obviously we wish we could be out there practicing with them, but I do think there are benefits to that. And then to the Ivy League and the state of the Ivy League right now, I think the one word that best describes all the teams is passion. You know, when something's taken away from you, that's a real strong part of your identity, which is playing and competing and, you know, the brotherhood of it all. And when you take that away, I think it really clarifies the importance of it. And I think some of the distractions that you may typically have as an Ivy League student, not distractions, just demands on your time. I think there's an even more mature approach to that, where yes, you know, academically it will always be, you know, a huge priority at the Ivy League schools, but I think guys are managing their time to train, you know, more like those guys, you know, you see in the rest of Division One and some of those, you know, the power conferences. So, you know, the passion displayed on the field from all the Ivy League programs, then the recruiting. I mean, there's been some really special players that have left these programs in the past couple of years, but every program's been recruiting at a pretty high level. So I think you're starting to get glimpses of the, you know, the next wave of Ivy League star athletes. And it's real exciting. And I think it's a juggernaut of a league.
Yeah, I think that's great. And we've talked about it with other coaches on here, the early start to the season. Lacrosse is not high level. It's kind of gross. And there's also something about wearing players down, the people that are starting January 1st, 2nd, that first week of the year. You guys, at first, I kind of thought, oh, man, why won't the Ivy League let their lacrosse teams practice? But now, I mean, I totally see it as a benefit to you guys. Not only are teams not getting that early scout on you, but you guys are flying around the field. You look big, strong, and athletic. A team with fresh legs, tons of energy. And there's something to be said about that. And the Ivy League as a whole, I think you guys went 6-0 yesterday. It's impressive right now. And it's still funny because, you know, when we were playing college lacrosse, it seems like this was still pretty early in the year. This was normally like game one or two, not teams that are already 5, 6, 7 games into their season. So, I mean, I think it's a benefit for you guys totally. And to kind of get more onto the recruiting side of the Ivy League, Jeremy, I'm going to steer this question in your direction, right? You are getting great recruits and you do have a different process. And we do want to talk, we try to educate the high schoolers out there that are going through the recruiting process, trying to understand like what kid in this country doesn't want to go to Princeton and play lacrosse, right? So try to understand and give them kind of like a timeline or a layout of your recruiting process, which is very different. There's teams out there on September 1st getting guys committed early in their junior year, where maybe you in the Ivy League can't exactly guarantee a spot just yet for those types of players. So your current juniors, the 23 class, and then this upcoming summer, the 24 class. What is the process of when you're recruiting a player to Princeton? What does that kind of look like? And what is that timeline like, and what goes into all of that?
Sure. I mean, the timeline is unique, I think, for each prospect. I think specifically maybe for us, you know, needing that combination of lacrosse ability and academics, the timeline might be a little bit later, or the growth and development, there's more time for the growth and development and until we can feel comfortable you know, making a decision on a prospective student athlete, you know, but each year is unique. Each player is unique. You know, in the 2022 recruiting class, things moved, at a maybe a slower pace. The most recent recruiting cycle moved a little bit faster. And there's a bunch of different, I guess, factors that play into that. So it really depends. The academics is a big piece to it. I mean, you have to have the lacrosse ability as well. There's some things with grades and, you know, seeing guys continue to excel in the classroom or develop themselves academically. There's just a time frame to that, timeline to that. And then obviously lacrosse wise, just seeing guys continue to improve. We recruit all the way up until the end. You know, we've filled classes, you know, right up until the end of the summer of a young man's junior season. So it really each year is different.
I'd like to shed a little bit more light on the academic piece, and it's different at Princeton than it is anywhere else in the world. But the Ivy League as a whole, and I just think for the listeners understanding kind of, and you mentioned it, the trend of their academic progress is very important, not just at Princeton or in the Ivy League, but at any school. So if they find themselves in a hole from a GPA standpoint, you know, they always, an admissions office is always going to look and say, what's the trend look like over the course of like the last 2-3 years versus just, okay, you had one bad year, or the opposite of that, where somebody may be very high academically and then they drop off of a cliff after they verbally commit. And that could look very, very bad on their transcript, and the admissions department may not let them in. But from an academic standpoint, like what would be a GPA or an SAT score that it would like take them out of the conversation in an Ivy League institution? You don't need to be specific to Princeton, but just an estimation there. And what kind of GPA and SAT score would you look at and say, the door is open here? It's not shut from an academic standpoint, if you can share those details.
Sure. Well, the SAT and the standardized testing is an interesting topic right now. The Ivy League institutions for this current admission cycle, it was test optional. So they weren't if you did well, you could submit those scores, and then you didn't have to if you felt like that wasn't going to enhance your profile. So they're going through, I think college admissions as a whole is going through a transition period right now and trying to figure out the best metrics for prospective student athletes. And then what that's going to look like for the future, they're still trying to figure that out, whether that's going to be the standardized testing is going to be utilized moving forward. It sounds like from what we hear, it's a little bit unknown whether SATs and ACTs will be used moving forward. So that what that means is how students do in the classroom is huge, you know, in terms of getting the best grades they can, taking adequate classes, you know, challenging classes, and doing really well in those. Much like the lacrosse piece, like if you see an upward trajectory, if you see consistent improvement, that's always a positive for us as a coaching staff in terms of our evaluation of them. And then obviously in admissions, seeing guys continue to improve, take challenging courses, do better than they did the year before, honestly, and continue to excel are things that, you know, tell a good story, can give shed some light and on the young man's character, their work ethic. And all those things are factors in terms of, us moving forward and offering them an opportunity to go through the admissions process.
What's the balancing act of like recruiting to an institution like Princeton? So Jim, you bring a recruit on campus, obviously it's the best university in the world for rankings, right? Like top two anyway. You know, how much do you focus on how good of a university and educational experience it is versus the lacrosse piece with such a rich tradition? Like how do you guys balance that? And every program has a brand and a message they're trying to send when they bring a recruit on campus. What's that message for you guys?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, the number one ranking academically, like, I think most people know that when they step on campus. So, you know, we're not shy to echo that, but it's more about like what specifically, you know, separates Princeton from some of our, you know, peer institutions. And at Princeton, it's really the focus on the undergraduate students. You know, there's far more undergraduates on campus than grad school students. So it's a place that's like the, you know, the Princeton bubble, they refer to it as a little bit younger. than some of the other ones. And then a lot of the resources, you know, financial resources are allocated towards those undergraduates. The professors who work at Princeton love to work with that undergraduate age student population. So those are the things we kind of focus on, what makes Princeton a little bit different, you know, whether it's the curriculum, you know, what your day-to-day environment's like, you know, what's different about our alumni network. You know, obviously the tradition falls into that with all those guys through the 90s and early 2000s that are, you know, starting to have kids that are recruitable age and are kind of some guys that may have, you know, maybe not paid a ton of attention to Princeton lacrosse are now very back and engaged with a kind of this exciting new era of Ivy League lacrosse. So, and then when it comes to lacrosse side, you know, we take it, you know, just as seriously as any ACC Big Ten type program with how, you know, our performance, our sports and performance training stuff. We want to be up to date, modern, you know, focus on health and nutrition at a really high level. And we have guys that have a really high capacity to do things and understand things. And I think we just try to show that high performance model is very much possible in the Ivy League, and also, you know, helps the demands on your time. You know, if you're focusing on sleep and aware of how that's important, how sleep and training and performance all is blended together, you know, it helps guys in the classroom, you know, helps them socially and feel good about, you know, where they're at Princeton. It's a challenging school, but there's a lot of tools for you to navigate that, in which we're, you know, proud to share. And, you know, obviously the long line of successful young men coming from Princeton, not unique to Princeton, but something we're proud of. And, you know, each prospect is motivated by different things. And we're excited to find, you know, what that is and share how Princeton does that well.
Jim, you talked about it right there, just saying, you know, you're looking for those, the ACC, the Big Ten type athletes, those type of guys, for whatever reason it might be, you just don't associate like high powered, a lot of goals type offense, I would say, with maybe Princeton or Ivy League lacrosse. Maybe that was because Bill Tierney's teams were so good back in the day and he wouldn't let them score more than 19 goals. That was like his showing respect to his opponent. 19 goals was it, but you're doing it. And your offenses, wherever you've been, have been scoring a ton of goals. So what I'm interested in, you're showing up to your first summer recruiting tournament. You have a blank canvas. What are you looking for in players? What kind of guys are fitting that Princeton offense and that type of offense that you want to build and continue to build on? I mean, you're scoring a lot of goals, and I think people are really starting to notice that wherever you are. So what are you looking for out of these players when you're showing up and looking for that next recruit, that next, you know, it's not going to be the next Michael Sowers. And if you find him, congratulations, because that's a special thing. But, you know, what kind of guys are you trying to put into your offense?
Sometimes I have a hard time answering that question because I can get caught in, you know, in so many different rabbit holes for like what you're looking for from a defenseman or a midfielder. But I would say athletes in the midfield is absolutely essential to compete at a high level. You know, I say this like every other day, and you're only as good as your D-mids. You know, you're only as good as your rope unit. You know, your D-mids are going to be dodged all game long. They have to clear the ball. If they're, you know, capable on the offensive end, that gives you another potential advantage as well. So I think being strong through the midfield is really a requirement to compete at the highest level, which we want to be at, expect to be at. So I think if you look at teams that are able to sustain success, you'll see through the midfield, you know, whether, you know, it's the D middies, the wings on the faceoffs, you know, offensive midfielders, you need to have dynamic high level athletes. And we look for versatility is huge for me. You know, guys that can get a stop on the defense. Not that, you know, everyone has to be a two way middie, but I think when you play defense, you understand offense a little bit better. And you're looking for guys that are tough or competitive. Guys that want to go on the DN and get a stop and do what the program needs, like that shows that. So I'm always looking for that. Kids that, if they get, you know, that run off the field right away on offense, as opposed to maybe getting in the hole or just trying to read the play and make the right play, which could be subbing off, but some guys that just run right to the box. You know, if they score most of the time they're on the field on offense, you still might consider the kid, but we want people that are engaged in playing the game of lacrosse, not just executing what they naturally do well.
Same question to you, Jeremy, with the on the defensive side, you know, Damian Davis, some of these mean guys. I know you were a really mean defender too. You see the way you guys are playing now in terms of pretty aggressive and setting the perimeter and being physical on the ball. Like, what are some of the things that you're evaluating on the defensive side?
Sure. Well, my mean, it was the only way I could survive, you know, being 5'9" is my only chance. I mean, look, the assessment of defensemen in the recruiting process, it's something we talk about all the time as a staff of, you know, what we're looking for. One thing, like, you know, we're big on right now is the athletic IQ piece. And it's hard to honestly decipher in the recruiting process. You know, I just think about the current defensemen that we have playing for us. A couple of them, you know, specifically like Pace Billings and Ben Finley, these guys have tremendous athletic IQ. You know, they're able to process, you know, information and then, you know, make a decision at a really high rate and then execute. And it's really unique. And finding that in the recruiting process or evaluating that is difficult. I think a lot of coaches will say, look, you know, multi-sport athletes are, you know, that's one way to do it. You know, some of the defense we've coached or had that, you know, some have played or multi-sport athletes in high schools, others aren't. So I don't know if that is a foolproof part of the you know, evaluation process. You know, what we're trying to do right now in terms of like the aggressiveness or dictating and being assertive is honestly, it's just a product, I think, of like how we practice. You know, Coach Mitchell's offense, the ball movement and the way they change field so quickly. One way to survive that, I guess we figured out, is trying to be a little bit more assertive on the perimeter to disrupt flow. It's not something that I don't think we're great at right now, but it's something that we emphasize. You know, and then just studying other great defenses. You know, we played Maryland and obviously just played Georgetown, and, you know, studying how they do things, you know, either systematically or personnel wise is something we're always taking note of and trying to emphasize with our guys. Maybe some of it worked well yesterday, but it's still a work in progress.
It did. Apparently it did work well yesterday.
And with that, first of all, you know, shout out to all the 5'9" defenders out there. I think, you know, I think we're holding it down. It's great. You know, drive guys' hips. You're nice and low. You don't have to get as low as some of those big athletic athletes that, you know, everyone loves to recruit. So I believe in the 5'9" defender. I also believe in a guy named Eric Peters. I had to bring up his name right now. Phenomenal goalie that I've known since he was 13 years old and is playing great for you guys. Is there any, like, teams talk about, and I remember doing this at Hopkins, there's certain shots that goalies like to see. Jesse Schwartzman liked certain things. Is there an element to building a defense around a goalie like Eric Peters, things that he wants to see? Or is it just, all right, you're a good goalie, go make saves, and we're going to play defense the way it seems best for us?
Honestly, Matt, it's a little bit of both. Like, Eric is so unique in his ability to be consistent in his mindset. He's unflappable. So in terms of like the shots he wants to see, yeah, it's a constant conversation. We talk to him all the time about, you know, where he's most comfortable or what shots he's most comfortable seeing. And we'll talk about game plan wise and what we're thinking from the opponents and what, trying to neutralize what they do best and how that fits kind of his style and what he likes to see. So honestly, it's a little bit of both. You know, it's having those conversations as a unit and with him. I will say one thing that's been incredible, I think, for Eric and our program, and Jim touched on it earlier, is, you know, Chris Aslanian, working with our goalies and as a current pro player, and the velocity and the accuracy with which he can shoot and replicating different shooters has been phenomenal. And then you combine that with Matt Madelon, who was, you know, a pro goalie, a standing goalie himself. So that goalie coaching group and how those guys train has been phenomenal for, I mean, obviously our defensive unit, you know, you're only as good as your goalie. So, I mean, they do a phenomenal job. So I think it's a little bit of everything. It's a full, like, all encompassing approach to that. But Eric's ability to, you know, yesterday, the first possession of the game, we got scored on. And, you know, we just kind of reset and went forward and stuck to the game plan. He's just unflappable. And obviously has lightning quick hands. He's a, you know, a natural reactor. So, you know, he's been great for us. Backbone of the defense.
You guys as a staff, you had mentioned like right now, you don't think you're great at disrupting flow on the perimeter. Talk a little bit about you, like, and this can be a group conversation, you guys with Coach Madelon. How much do you care about what you look like right now as opposed to your development over the course of the season and things that you want to maybe implement down the line and make sure that you're playing your best lacrosse over Memorial Day or the beginning of May, whatever it may be in your guys' head? How much do you care about the results right now as to opposed to where you want the team to be in a month or two?
I think we just react to the information we continue to get. And I think that's sort of a programmatic thing, especially when you take 2 years off. You know, we had over all that time, you know, we had an idea of what our team was going to look like when it came back and what roles guys are going to be. And very quickly, we started playing other teams, even in scrimmages, things changed. Some things didn't, but other things drastically changed, like what role a certain player is going to have and how to use them. So there's theory and reality. And all the conversations you have and what you think guys can do theoretically when you actually put the pads on and the jerseys on and have the refs out there, you learn new things. And I think it's, you know, it's our responsibility for the experience we have coaching is to, you know, try and make those decisions when we see things come up. Sometimes you want to forecast the future and maybe get guys experience in certain roles because you think they're going to, you know, need to do it later. But you know, our approach offensively is, we take a very neutral approach to, you know, every single possession. There are emotions in the game that are undeniable. You know, we want to celebrate the success we have. And when things don't go wrong, like, yeah, it's not, you're not going to smile all the time. But in the end, you just got to take the information from that possession, quarter, game, and apply it to what's next. And, you know, I heard Coach Crowan on your last interview say, you know, the most important shot is the next shot. And you can sort of apply that logic to a whole lot of ways you coach your team. And that's what we try to do. You know, certainly our goals are lofty for the end of the season, but really, you know, there's really no other way than that, like day to day or even, you know, minute to minute approach.
And you talk about goals for your team this year. Now we want to get a little bit more personal and talk about your own goals as coaches. You know, you're in their mid 30s, you're young guys, you've shown the ability to be successful coaches, potential head coaches down the line. You've got to develop, play under good coaches, coach with other, you know, great guys. Kind of talk about, we'll start with you, Jeremy, where, you know, things that maybe you've learned from some of the coaches that you've been with before that you've taken away, some guys that might've been big influences on you and not just the way you coach, but potentially where you want your career as a coach to end up. So what does that kind of look like for you?
Sure. I guess I would start by saying, I mean, some of the biggest role models I've had in the coaching world is probably, you know, Dave Metzbauer, who I guess arguably is a career assistant. You know, I don't want to speak for him, but I know he takes a lot of pride in the units he's coached and the relationships he's built with student athletes. You know, I have a relationship with him and, hold that very highly, that relationship. And then, you know, obviously I worked with Greg Raymond, who was, a great coordinator at Princeton and then the head coach at Hobart. And, you know, obviously worked for Matt Madelon, who was a great assistant, great offense coordinator, and obviously the head coach at Princeton right now. So I think I've been around a mix of coaches that love, coaching a side of the ball and then others that have, you know, excelled being leaders of an entire program. So, you know, I'm still, I guess specifically to me, I'm still learning and growing. And I have, you know, goals I want to accomplish as an assistant that I haven't yet. So I'm still working towards those. And, you know, I think the group of guys, at least on the entire team, but specifically the defense, like I love the guys that I work with and it's a special group of guys that we have on the defensive side. And those relationships that I can continue to build and the things we want to do defensively and as a program is still in front of us. So super happy. Obviously I love Princeton. I love the tradition. And but specifically the people, the coaches I work with currently, and the players, they're phenomenal. You know, I will say about like our guys, like they like Coach Mitch said, like a lot was taken from them or put on, you know, had to put aside with COVID, and having that opportunity back in front, like, they're the best dudes to work with. They come to practice every day, and they just want to get better. I don't even know if like it's saying like they have a lot to prove is the right way to do it. Say it. They care a lot about each other. They care a lot about this program, and they want to put all the pieces together because they know how good they can be. It's just a really unique environment. It's a unique environment. They work their butts off. They competed, you know, tremendously yesterday, and we see that on a daily basis. So it's a lot of fun working with those guys. So super happy.
You mentioned just the goals that you have for the defense that you maybe haven't accomplished yet, but are those the obvious things, like have a top unit in the game, or what are those?
Yeah. Like, you know, I pride myself in wanting to coach like really good fundamental, tough defense. And, you know, we've had glimpses here and there, but I want to be that needs to be consistent. I think highly of specific coordinators in the game at certain programs. And, I want to coach units like that consistently. And we have all the pieces here to do it at Princeton with our current guys, our recruits, you know, Matt being a former goalie and understanding the importance of defense. So it's the perfect situation. So yeah, the obvious, you know, just coaching great defense, helping a program, you know, achieve team goals with just a backbone of strong defense. I mean, I don't know, like Princeton traditionally has played great defense. So I'd love to, you know, we don't talk about it a lot, like getting back to like how Princeton played defense, but certainly, you know, that's something that a lot of those championships were built on, obviously with great offense as well. So just things I'd like to continue to contribute towards.
You guys invented sliding. Coach Tierney like invented the sliding. I remember watching a national championship game. I'm pretty sure Princeton was playing Maryland, and the defense is like sliding. There's two slides. They're rotating, recovering. And I'm watching, that's like a 10-year-old, like what the heck is going on out there? And they, even the commentators were trying to explain Coach Tierney, you know, slide packages, hots, twos, that type of stuff. It was like Princeton invented that, which is pretty wild. But Coach Mitchell, talk a little bit about, I mean, you have a path that's gone all over the place. And now you've really, I mean, shown what you can do as an offensive coach. Kind of who were some of your influences and got you to where you are now? And, you know, feel free to talk a little bit about where you'd like to go from here.
Well, I've been incredibly fortunate with the quality of coaches I've worked for and with, and then the people, you know, just as important. You know, I played for Jamie Block at St. Mary's College, who was a great mentor to us, challenged us, took great care of us, and treated us like young men, not kids. And he was a Salisbury guy, came from Salisbury. So, I think, you know, we had a version. It's been a while, but thinking back on it, I think we did a lot of things, you know, identity-wise that Salisbury did, which you continue to see, you know, them to be, you know, really set the high bar for year in, year out performance. So I think I learned. So, you know, in the moment, I don't know, you know, if I was able to comprehend all the things, but certainly I had a good foundation to enter college coaching. With Kyle Hannon at Goucher. He was at Mercer for a number of years. He's at Queens now, but he was a great, you know, he built the program up at Goucher, did a great job in communicating the team and maximizing potential. And then I got a chance to work with Bill Pilot at Roanoke, and we were run and gun chaos, pressing on the perimeter defensively. And we had some great teams and great battles in Division III. I really honestly cherish those years. And then had the opportunity to go into Division I, which was my goal, get to Division I. And I got to be the volunteer assistant at Duke in 2011. And I always refer to that as like my master's experience in coaching. The 2010 team had won the national championship with a lot of fifth year guys, older guys. You know, Ned Crotty was on that team. A ton of great players were on that team. And then the 2011 team, when I got there, was a very young team. You know, Jordan Wolf was a freshman in that group. It was a highly regarded crop of freshman student athletes and some talented older guys, but guys that really hadn't had a ton of on-field experience. So I got to watch like the raw like ball of clay early on, like took some lumps, moved some pieces around, and then made a run to the Final Four with a really young team. So I got to see like really what, you know, hands-on coaching looks like at the highest level. And all those coaches, Coach Gabrielli, Coach Nowski, obviously outstanding coaches. And, you know, but Coach Caputo, Ron Caputo has been a real mentor of mine from the first day I got to Duke through now, sharing ideas and helping me understand like why teams do certain things, not just like what you're seeing on the film and, you know, the philosophy behind it and how to, you know, communicate with your student athletes and be yourself. And then also be humble, like realize you know, you don't ever have it all figured out. It's really okay to ask questions and continue to, you know, audit the things you do, question the things you do. So unbelievable experience working at Duke in that year, and then the continued relationships with those guys. And then, you know, at Rutgers, Coach Breck, you look at what he's built brick by brick by brick at Rutgers. And we had a great transformation, you know, led by him and all the hard work behind the scenes. And I inherited a younger group there when I got there and helped, got the chance to build that with the greatest staff with Coach Brecht. And then on the defensive end, Coach Jesse Bernhardt and then Coach John Gorman. I mean, these are guys that like, you just want to go to war with. These are the guys you want on your side. And then obviously having the opportunity to end up here at Princeton. When I first got I grew up about an hour away in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. And, when I was in high school was, you know, the tail end of like Princeton's like dominance there. I, you know, got my driver's license. Some of the first places I ever went were to Princeton lacrosse games. So to kind of come full circle and be able to coach at this institution with the quality of the student athletes and the staff members and being around my family, I've got, you know, a couple of kids and you know, family nearby, family and friends nearby. Like, there's no greater place to coach than Princeton University. So, you know, in the future, like I'd like to be a head coach, but, you know, the fact that you're working at a place that people care deeply about the lacrosse program, the alums are incredibly supportive and also, you know, want us to perform at a high standard, which is exciting. When people care, you know, there's no shortage of motivation to do the best you can. But to echo Coach Hirsch, like our guys, I've loved pretty much every team I've ever coached. I guess I like coaching. The guys, but this group's just different. And I don't know if it's the, you know, part of it's the, you know, the COVID stuff, the camaraderie, a lot of it's Coach Madelon's vision for the program, the type of people he brings in, not just the talent, but the people. But every day I wake up excited to get in and spend time with these guys.
Well, that's scary for the rest of the Ivy League to hear that this group is different. I mean, you have a ton of experience working with some really great groups. So the fact that this one stands out is pretty impressive. Tell us about what the word NASCAR means to you. I know that this is original Rutgers thing. Is this still a term you use now? And and just from, you know, the way you operated your offenses, I still remember a conversation we had on the sideline when you were at Rutgers about the way you run in between the lines and some of the things you were doing there. How has that evolved? And I guess it's kind of a similar question that we asked Coach Kerwin. I think both of you guys are pretty unique in the way that you do things, and the proof's in the pudding, like you're putting numbers up. What's NASCAR and kind of how's your offensive philosophies evolved through that process with those people that you just mentioned?
Now, you know, Rutgers is certainly, you know, trademarked NASCAR. But I look back on those days, you know, with those, that was a really special time and for me, my coaching career. And, you know, I think with the program as well, but you know, when I got to Rutgers, my first year, I was a defensive coordinator there, and I had Coach Bernhardt with me, and he was just very much ready to be a defensive coordinator, even at a young age. And I had always wanted to coach offense, but you know, my experiences up to that point, I was the D guy, defensive coordinator, which I loved as well, but I always sort of wanted to, you know, scratch that itch. And
every D guy wants to be an O guy, like players, coaches, that's across the board. Just ask Matt Bocklet. That's why he got so good at ground balls and pushing the ball in transition. There's not a D guy in the country that doesn't want to score goals or play offense.
That's because no O guy in the country that was going to pass me the ball. So I had to figure out to get it on my own. That was the only way I was ever going to get a chance to score a goal.
I assisted you on a couple, Matt. That's you're lying. Anyway, sorry,
Jim. You never had an assist in your career.
That's good. Your Twitter picture is an assist for me in an all-star game, Matt. Watch the film.
Okay.
Okay. Jim,
no,
sorry.
I think, no, it's, no, I get it. I'm a happier man. My mental health is better as an offensive coach. Defensively, it's like the football mentality. You know, you're either right or wrong a lot of the times. Offensively, there's a lot of that gray area, which I like that. I like coaching that. But the origins of NASCAR, which Rutgers continues to, you know, display their version of it now. That originated when I was able to, you know, Coach Brecht gave me the green light to take over the offense. And at the same time, it was coming off the first year in the Big Ten where, you know, I don't know, like, it's not that we were in over our heads, but, you know, we just looked at our roster and then we looked at the other ones and filled with all the top recruits and ranked guys and all that. And we were a new program in the Big Ten as a university, and the conference started. So, you know, we had incredible players on that team that are still playing pro, but none of them were ranked recruits. So we sort of looked at the strengths of our team. You know, maybe if we try to bog down, this is pre-shot clock as well. So, you know, we didn't think that, you know, playing 6-on-6 and trying to play the chess matches with the programs and staffs we were going up against, we didn't really think that was the best way to attack it. We wanted to be the best at something that, you know, only we did. And we had a lot of two-way middies, guys that Christian Scarpello and Christian Mazzone who play in the PLL right now, really dynamic LSMs as well. And so that was sort of the strength of our team, was our rope unit. And then, you know, you saw some other guys really start to emerge throughout that year when we went to that up-tempo style. So, you know, make plays in transition. We had an attack that was pretty special. And when you combined it with some strong senior leadership with guys that really wanted to have, you know, their second year in the Big Ten go better than their first year in the Big Ten, you just saw it sort of come together with that style of play. It's really exciting. You never feel like you're out of a game when you want to push transition. And your middies can play a little defense and offense. It makes your practices go well because all the D middies get to play offense too and impact the game. And you get to do a lot of drills that are fun, honestly. Like, I don't know if you're in a program that likes to push tempo a little bit or attack early, you tend to do a lot of more like scramble and numbers type drills. And, you know, most people only play at one program, so they don't really know if their practices are fun or not. But I've been in a few programs and I can tell you that the style we like to practice and like to practice at Rutgers is a lot of fun to play. So I thought we sort of, you know, rode that energy and then have an opportunity to bring that style of play to Princeton. You know, when Coach Malon brought me on board, he really wanted me to bring that style and which I love because the team was built for that with guys like Jake Stevens and Bo Pettersson and, you know, Luke Anderson, and now some of the new crop of guys we have doing it, Luke Crimmins and Marquez White. We're able to kind of replicate in some ways the things we did at Rutgers, but the shot clock does change that. So I think the mentality is we used to be able to do it in phases where, you know, at Rutgers, we wanted to attack in transition, you know, hopefully gain a numbers advantage, get the ball up and out, push the ball. And then if we didn't get anything or didn't have numbers, we'd just attack early while we sub and, you know, hopefully attacking an O midi that's on the D end, really just playing while we sub. And we'd end up scoring all these goals. And, you know, we had five guys in the field and they'd have six guys in the field, but the last guy would be sort of standing at the top of the box waiting for our offensive guy to come on, and he'd miss like a rotation on the backside. So it was like this attacking in the gray area. And after that, if we didn't get anything from the early offense, we would just go to 6-on-6. The shot clock does not allow for that. So you don't really have the multifaceted approach to it. There's some room for it, but you have to be a little bit more dialed in with like who you're trying to go after defensively or what players you want to use. But I still think that mentality of attacking off the faceoffs, trying to push numbers, take advantage of matchups, or, you know, when you in maybe, you know, you invert while you sub and the team can't get into their, you know, their invert package they prefer to. So there's just little advantages. And overall, you know, something, you know, philosophically I like to say is a quote from Jeff Bezos, Princeton guy. Not sure he loves lacrosse like Joe Tsai does, but we certainly welcome Jeff Bezos. So we'll send him some gear, get him on board. But he has a great quote that said, you know, when he was building Amazon, you know, he didn't exactly know where it was going to go, but his whole, his goals were to, you know, weave a rope of small advantages, you know, that together like becomes, you know, your identity and something that only you can do. And so I think NASCAR is a tool in doing that. a way you can create an advantage that, you have, there's something that you do different that every team that plays you has to sort of deal with a short window to prepare for it. So ultimately, I think it's energizing wherever any team that plays that way. It energizes the program and your practices.
Yeah.
I could see the passion of just you talking about it, how excited you got. Jeremy's over there kind of shaking his head a little bit. What are your thoughts there on the NASCAR, Coach Hirsch? Is that something that you're trying to do with the defense a little bit, teaching them how to run and gun?
Well, we certainly recruit poles that can handle the ball. But the flip side in practice, I mean, having to defend NASCAR on a daily basis and the way we have to structure practices certainly has, I think it's helped us be aware, at least. We're still, still working on defending it, but, we have an element of our defense that we do on a daily basis. So when we see it in games, like it's not something new. There's been, in the past, you're preparing for certain programs, maybe like a UVA that, certainly runs and runs an element of early offense. So if you don't if your program doesn't do it, it's something that during game week you have to prepare for. So now it's kind of ingrained in the way we do things. So from a preparation standpoint or an ability to defend, it's just something that we do. So it's certainly, I guess, long way of saying it's enabled us to somewhat defend early offense, maybe a little bit better than some of the teams I've been on or coached before.
I'd also say it all, and I need to always remember this, all NASCAR early offense push transition, it all starts at the defensive end. It does. So when we show those NASCAR clips tomorrow to the guys, like that'll all start on the DN with a great save, a great check, a great ground ball. So, if you want to play that way, you have to have the defensive personnel that can execute, get the ball up and out and make those plays.
Best road unit of all time. I think we got an educated group that can all give an opinion on this. What's the best rope unit of all time? Jim, who you got? Well,
so I coach against this rope unit. It's the Loyola, national championship Loyola team.
Yeah.
They were unreal. And the attack too. Like when you blend the rope with the attack. So you have the rope that, if they have that skill set, and you also need the attack that has to like make the decisions. And the rope unit's doing a lot. So the attack's the ones that have to be a little bit more mindful of the game situation, the clock, what the coaches were communicating to you when the ball was on the other end. So when you combine that attack unit with that rope unit, I think that sets probably the high bar.
Coach Hirsch.
Well, Pete, what I was going to say, we talked in the office a little bit about what Casey Broderson and Bryant, they've always done, more from like how they get the ball up and out so quickly, winning the first five, creating advantages off shot saves, something that we've talked about as a staff and have tried to emulate. I referenced that just going back to the Hobart days of, I just thought they were phenomenal when we were coaching against them. They just create so much offense on the defensive side. It's just of note. And talking to Casey and seeing some of the things that they do, it's certainly coached and recruited towards. So things that we're just aware of and trying to have a focus on with our program.
They break out both ways so well, like running shots out on the one side and then breaking out to the midfield line, and it's like jailbreak both ways. Like if you're not reacting that offensively, you're going to lose possessions, you're going to give up goals in transition. It sucked.
And what I found too is in terms of like backing up shots or getting up out, and there's certainly an element of coaching to it, and there's also a certain element of I guess maybe that back to the athletic IQ. We have a couple guys on our team that, yes, we talk about it, we coach it, and other guys, and some guys have this instinctual ability to back up shots and whatnot. So a little bit of both coaching and, the type of player.
We used to make the feeder run to the end line after feeding and shooting drills week of Bryant so that we would not lose possessions. And we always did. We always lost one or two a game. It was crazy. Matt, who you got, rope unit?
Outlaws 2009, Mike Law from Duke. That guy threw better takeaway checks than anyone on our team with a short stick. Casey Cittadino, a very young Kevin Understein. That group liked to run. That was a fun group.
Yeah.
To watch play. I didn't even have to play any defense. And that was the LSM watching those guys. That was a ton of fun watching them.
Yeah.
Matt, you should watch a couple, keep watching our games. We have a poll, Andrew Song, not the biggest guy in the world, but
already my favorite.
Yeah. He's a lefty, you know, not like you, but not a righty like you, but the way he can handle the ball and you know, some of the things he can do on the defensive end. He's I think you would like his game. We certainly do.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to watching you guys. You know, I think it's going to be a nice long season for this Princeton team that, you know, you've already played arguably the best team in the country. I think you've already beaten one of the top three teams in the country. So putting you guys right there in the conversation is great. You know, digging a little deeper and getting to know you guys, your staff, you know, where you come from, where you're headed. But I think, you know, this spring is going to be a great one for you guys. And I'm looking forward to seeing how the team continues to develop and how you guys push and make this deep run into May. So appreciate you guys coming on. Congrats on the big win, great start to the season. And hopefully we're getting you back on maybe early June to talk about celebrations and things of that nature. And it'd be a lot of fun too. I'm always interested in the post game party and what's happening there. So would like to hear how you guys celebrate as a staff.
That's the case. We're going live.
Yeah, we'll go live from that one.
Let's ride. Let's ride, guys.
Let's ride. Yeah. Exactly.
There you go.
Let's ride.
Perfect. Thanks for coming on, fellas. Good luck.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.